coming up on the Mindful Midlife Crisis.
I think context is everything. I keep going back to this pandemic, but you know, I graduated with my undergraduate degree during the Great Recession, and then I graduated with my doctorate during a global pandemic. So a little square piece of paper that you hang on the wall as a little status symbol did not matter that much to me when there is, you know, regardless of what political side you land on with this, there's mass illness and death, and there is mass hysteria and confusion. So why would I care about professional life when mortality is staring me in the face?
Welcome to the Mindful Midlife Crisis, a podcast for people navigating the complexities and possibilities of life's second half. Join your hosts, Billy and Brian, a couple of average dudes who will serve as your armchair life coaches as we share our life experiences, both the good and the bad, in an effort to help us all better understand how we can enjoy and make the most of the life we have left to live in a more meaningful way. Take a deep breath, embrace the present, and journey with us through the Mindful Midlife Crisis.
Welcome to the Mindful Midlife Crisis. I'm your host, Billy, and as always, I'm joined by my good friend, Brian, on the bass. Brian, how you doing over there, man?
I am pretty hot and tasty, otherwise known as fat.
Oh, that is a completely different direction than what I thought you were going with that. Pretty hot and tasty. I've never heard that acronym before.
Did you not know that that's what fat stands for? Pretty hot and tasty? That's what it means, dude. You never knew that?
No. Are you serious?
Dead serious. I've heard that. I didn't just make that up. I heard that.
Oh, my God. No, I never knew that. I never knew that that's what it was. That's beautiful. Oh, I am today years old when I learned what fat actually meant. So, well, I love it.
From the streets like me.
You're right. That's right. I'm book smart, not street smart like you.
That's what it is. So that's why I know that sort of stuff. I hang out in those circles.
Well, that's perfect because our guest today is both book smart and street smart. Our guest today is Dr. David J. DeMarcus. Dr. DeMarcus is a disenchanted former educator turned digital nomad who holds, count them, 1, 2, 3, 4 degrees in different topics of inquiry in the humanities and social sciences. A man prone to bouts of existential crises. This guy sounds just like me. Dr. DeMarcus decided to leverage the global pandemic to reimagine his life. In 2020, he took to the trails and the weight room and lost over 30 pounds. Congratulations to you. He proceeded to buy an RV on his 33rd birthday, ditching rent totally in 2021 and conquering over 100 state parks along the way. In 2022, his goal is to capture 100 sunsets around the world. I've got sunsets in Portugal for days that you can go and check out.
Yeah.
Dr. DeMarcus is a full-time freelancer who currently is working a contract making language assessments for the U.S. military. He spends a third of his time in the RV, a third in international Airbnbs, and a third with family and friends in the United States and Mexico. You can follow his batshit crazy journey on Instagram. His handle is at feral_visions. Welcome to the show, Dr. David DeMarcus.
Thank you for having me. I'm so excited to be here. Yeah. That was an epic introduction.
That's quite a pedigree, dude.
Yeah, that's very impressive.
Thank you. Thank you.
And I don't know if you guys remember, if you listened to the episode that we did with Brett Hill, I had talked about, I connected with somebody over Instagram about who is pursuing a PhD in higher consciousness. Well, that's Dr. David DeMarcus. That's why he's here today. He is here to talk about that pursuit for higher consciousness. And we've just talked a little bit more over the last few weeks. And I got to admit, I think you're on the right path, David. I think you're on that path to seeking out higher consciousness. So we wanted to bring you on the show, and we feel like this is an excellent way to put a bow on this amazing season we have had so far around reinventing your life, because that's something that you have figured out much earlier than the rest of us have. So let's do this. Let's get into what 10 roles you play in your life. So what are the 10 roles that you play?
So I think I broke the rules. I have more than 10 here, but the 10 roles I play, I'm a digital nomad. When I asked Madi, my fiance, what I am, she said, you better tell them you're a disruptor, because that's what you do. You shake things up a bit. I'm a man of contradictions, a minimalist, divergent thinker, a blue-collar scholar. I jokingly refer to myself as a professor of the people. I'm a vagabond at heart. I'm forever a free agent in life, and I am a class clown or a jester of the court. And my alter ego, as you said, is Feral Visions. You could follow me at Feral_Visions on Instagram.
Yeah, we were joking before the show that you're kind of bouncing all over the world like a feral cat. It's hard for you to stay in one spot.
Yeah, yeah. Take ADHD and scale it on a global level, and that is who I am. Yeah. Those kids in school that used to bounce around the classroom in elementary school and high school, I'm that guy, and now I have mobility, so I'm all over the place.
So you talked about being that kid who bounced off the wall. How does that tie into being the class clown or the jester of the court? Because that's one of the roles that you listed here as what you're most looking forward to in the second half of life.
Yeah, that's that's definitely a role I think I've had my whole life. And I think what's interesting is I struggled in the professional world because not every professional context is set up for that personality and set up for someone who likes to joke or have a good time. And I struggled in public education specifically with how strict that profession felt to me. And I was also in the role of a dean of students. So it was kind of weird. I'm the dean of students working with kids that were like me, but relating to those children, but then also having to put in a disciplinary system, which didn't vibe well with my personality. So yeah, I'm a class clown. I like to use humor. I think humor is a great place for creative freedom. And I like to use humor as a way to kind of poke fun at these traditional constructs in our society and dismantle these constructs through clowning and just humor. I mean, today I have my glasses on here. I'm in my workout clothes. I mean, this is my goofy ass personality, and that's just who I am.
When you look back on being a dean, because that's the role that I was in too. So when you look back on being a dean, what were some of the things that a student maybe was sent to your office for, or you had to do a disciplinary measure, but you're like, you know what? That was kind of funny.
There's a lot of those cases. It's just, what I'll say is it's difficult when you throw 30 plus kids into the same classroom that you all and I were in, and in 30 kids in those seats and 30 different personalities. And sometimes the teachers within those contexts are as stressed and frustrated as the students. And sometimes they pry open these rebellious personalities, but I don't have a specific moment. Like there's just crazy shit that happened. Like kids like running down to construction zones where I have to run after them and stuff. I mean, and we had this crazy, it was like a charter school. There was a crazy demerit system that was, they'd use technology. Every time a student did something wrong, they'd plug it in. So it was like a carrot and stick model. So it got to the point where these kids are just like, forget it. Like I can't do anything right with these teachers and these administrators. And I think the students just got deflated to the point where they're either rebellious and just like telling everyone to F off, or they're just deflated and sleeping in class because they're sick of consequence.
Well, I know Brian and I have had conversations before too about like, should we say this? Or, if we post this, how should we word this? Because if I'm in education and kids see this, how is this going to be portrayed if they're doing the exact same thing? So there's always that. And that's certainly come to a head at times. So, you know, it's right. It's a tricky situation to navigate. You also said here that you're a minimalist. I imagine that if you're roaming around the country, and especially if you're living in an RV, being a minimalist is crucial to living your lifestyle.
Oh, wow. It was such a process, too. Mari, my fiance, and I, when we got the RV and we're thinking about transitioning into living out of an RV or living out of a suitcase, you know, we realized how much junk we had. And we rented a 3-bedroom home in Austin to start. And then we downsized. We moved to Waco for a bit. We downsized to a 1-bedroom apartment. And then I was like, you know, I want to downsize even more. There's just so much junk, like material crap that you have that I just wanted to get rid of. It was just taking up space, taking up emotional space.
And your time. Well, I mean, when you own all this stuff, like if you own a boat, now you're, it's not just the time you're on the water. It's the time you're waxing the boat and cleaning it and putting it in storage and fixing the tire on the on the trailer and all this other stuff. So I know exactly what you mean, man.
Yeah. And we had like an HOA in Austin, and you have to mow the grass at a particular height. I'm working 12-hour days in a charter school. I'm coming home and then I have to mow the freaking grass at a specific height and edge the grass. And I was like, you know what? I'm done with this. I'm done with this lifestyle. I was never someone who aspired to a house. Like, I've never wanted the, you know, the American dream, and the suburban American dream never appealed to me. I grew up in a small halfplex in Pennsylvania, and there was so much love in that tiny home. You know, that's the lifestyle I'm about, is like, you don't need these big physical spaces that take up your time and take up your emotions when you could have a lot of love and happiness in a smaller space, and in mobility too. I enjoy mobility.
I remember I used to want the white picket fence and the house in the burbs and the 2.5 kids. And I know I've talked about this before, and I dated somebody who said, you know, I don't ever want to have kids. And I was like, what? That's an option? Like, it never dawned on me.
Yeah.
It reminds me of the conversation that we had with Dr. Yolanda and Tiffany Bird from the Trash the Checklist podcast. I was on that checklist, very much so. And like I said, I applaud you for being able to figure out to trash that checklist that society seems to normalize. And you are very successful. You are very well educated living this digital nomad life. So tell us more about why you're looking forward to being a digital nomad for the second half of your life.
One of the things I listed is I'm a huge proponent of calendar freedom. And the digital nomad lifestyle allows me to have that calendar freedom, because I'm a professional writer. So I'll write anything from technical writing, marketing writing, assessment writing, curriculum writing. And that means I could work odd hours, and they could work hours that are spaced out throughout the day. So I could put in 2 hours in the morning, 2 hours in the afternoon, you know, and then 4+ hours burning the midnight oil. And that excites me, because that allows me to move away from my last lifestyle where I'm working 6 a.m. till 6 p.m. as an educator. I'm not really getting paid much as an educator. And my hourly at that point is, you know, at that point I could have worked hourly. Like, I could have gone and worked at McDonald's and made more, I think, than what I made. So this allows me to, there's no cap on how much I can make. There's no specific calendar of time. There's no 9-to-5. So I get to hike during the day. If I need a break, I could go lift. And I think that is exactly what my mind and my personality needed to get through this, you know, existential crisis that I'm going through. I need freedom of time, considering I was also in a doctorate, which took up every weekend, you know, almost every weekend. Our classes were on weekends for 8 hours a day, once a month. So it would be 8 hours on Saturday, 8 hours on Sunday. You go back to work on Monday. You couldn't miss any classes, because if you missed class, you're potentially failing. So you're on this track, which is the opposite of what I see. I think education should be about. You're on this really strict track to the doctorate, and I felt confined. It confined my personality. You see me bouncing around now. It's hard to imagine that this personality that I have now was actually confined to one office, to one brick and mortar building, to a really tight calendar where there's no room to see family, no room for myself, no room for my relationship with my fiance. So that's why I'm excited for this digital nomad lifestyle.
And I imagine that if you are being a writer, that you can sit down and write when inspiration hits you or when you are feeling productive, that sort of thing. Because I'm sure there are times when it feels forced and it doesn't feel like your best work. And maybe you just need a walk and that'll clear your head and unlock what it is that you need to do in order to be creative when you sit down in front of the computer again and type up whatever it is that you're working on.
Absolutely. And it also eliminates all of that dead space that you have in a normal 9-to-5. So that dead space where you're not working, but you're still stuck within the context. But yeah, I could go take a break. Usually I do a lot of my work after I lift or work out or go on the trails, because that's where the inspiration hits me most. But it's good for my mental health because I'm able to step away. If I have writer's block, I've got to leave. There's no way I'm going to get through it. So it's easier for me to go on the trails and gain some inspiration.
Well, like we said before, we wanted to have you on so we could talk about this pursuit for higher consciousness. So what we want to do is we want to take a quick break. And then when we come back, we're going to continue talking to Dr. David DeMarcus. Thank you for listening to The Mindful Midlife Crisis.
Thank you for listening to The Mindful Midlife Crisis. If you're enjoying what you've heard so far, please do us a favor and hit the subscribe button. Also, giving our show a quick 5-star review with a few kind words helps us on our quest to reach the top of the podcast charts. Finally, since you can't make a mixtape for your friends and loved ones like you used to do, share this podcast with them instead. We hope our experiences resonate with others and inspire people to live their best lives. Thanks again. And now, let's take a minute to be present with our breath. If you're listening somewhere safe and quiet, close your eyes and slowly inhale for 4, 3, 2, 1. Hold for 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Slowly exhale for 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Let's do that one more time. Inhale for 4, 3, 2, 1. Hold for 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Slowly exhale for 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Go ahead and open your eyes. You feel better? We certainly hope so. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back to the Mindful Midlife Crisis. We are talking today to Dr. David DeMarcus. You can follow him on Instagram at feral_visions. And we're trying to learn more about what he means by this pursuit for higher consciousness. So, Dr. David, what do you mean by that, and how did this idea develop?
Well, as I was mentioning, I think my life, especially between the years of about 2016 and 2020, had become really unconscious, very rote, clocking into work, to the point that it became so unconscious that it's unhealthy for me. It was unhealthy financially. It was unhealthy mentally and emotionally, and is unhealthy physically. And that, combined with the course I took as a public educator and in working on my doctorate, and how much time was consumed by that, I became really disillusioned, not only with society and the norms and the status quo, but also just like disillusioned with myself. Like, I'm living this life that I never wanted. I'm living it for financial purposes more than meaning. And I'm not doing, there's no sense of self. There's no pursuit of anything higher than the day to day. And that unconsciousness really thrust me into this new lifestyle. And it was boiling for years inside of me, bubbling up inside of me for years. But really the pandemic allowed me to have the time and space, especially during quarantine, to really reflect and think about what is it that I want in life and where do I want to go with my life? And it wasn't what I was doing. It was, I needed to escape that lifestyle. So the pursuit of higher consciousness actually began, really it was a transition into this, I was trying to rebrand myself as a digital educator. And when I started to rebrand myself, I realized that I wanted to break off from education even more. And then also what was going on was there's this other aspect of financial consciousness that was beginning and health consciousness. And as I continued to, during the pandemic, I started going hiking and getting into the trails. And then as soon as I was on those trails, it became more of a spiritual journey for me, more of a higher conscious journey than I initially expected. I didn't expect this to be a pursuit of higher consciousness, right? It just happened as I took care of my body, as I took care of my mind, and as I changed my daily habits. It allowed me the space to think about something other than what's immediately in front of me.
There's something very relatable to that because I just got back from the Oregon coast and being out in nature and I've talked about before, just even being in Lisbon, being out in that fresh air, I feel like fresh air and trees are really underrated. Yes. When it comes to our mental health and our productivity, it almost feels like in these concrete jungles that we surround ourselves in urban places, that you almost need a recess. You need recess where you go outside and you it's forced. You can't stay inside with the teacher anymore. You have to go outside. And when do you stop with recess? You stop with recess around sixth grade. We might need to go back to recess. And I think people who are figuring that out are finding themselves to be more productive and they're happier and all around feel better. They're not completely wiped out at the end of the day. I'm sure that they're wiped out at the end of the day, but there might be something more to that. And we're really, really undervaluing the importance of being outside. I haven't been outside yet because I'm in Redmond, Washington, and it's raining. So there are the elements that you deal with too, especially as Minnesotans. Brian, I think it's negative 15 there today. Those elements play a role in that as well. But I'm curious to hear more about how nature has played a role in this mindset shift for you.
Yeah, I joke and, I guess it's not even a joke. I say the trees are my greatest therapy. And what I mean by that is there's a lot of stillness and solitude that I'm able to get in nature that is disrupted or destroyed, like you said, by the concrete jungle, especially in a place like Austin, Texas, where I lived, where you're stuck in traffic on I-35 for an hour. So you're not only working 6 to 6, then you have another hour in the beginning and the end of your day stuck in traffic. So nature, for me, has provided me with a space to escape the civilized world and kind of, some people call it a rewilding of your mentality or your body, or to tap into uncivilized parts of me that have been repressed by the concrete jungle and in society.
When we were looking at having you on as a guest, we just kind of knowing your story, it related really well to what the Trash the Checklist ladies talked about. And you were pursuing your doctorate. You have 4 degrees. And you posted recently on your Instagram that earning your doctorate was a small mountain you've climbed in your life, but you didn't like the view from the top. So what did you earn your doctorate in, and what was the view like up there once you got up there?
Yeah, I earned my doctorate in K-12 educational leadership. I think context is everything. I keep going back to this pandemic, but you know, I graduated with my undergraduate degree during the Great Recession, and then I graduated with my doctorate during a global pandemic. So a little square piece of paper that you hang on the wall as a little status symbol did not matter that much to me when there is, you know, regardless of what political side you land on with this, there's mass illness and death, and there is mass hysteria and confusion. So why would I care about professional life when mortality is staring me in the face? So imagine going to the top of the mountain and you're like, well, shit, that was a terrible hike anyway. I'm out of shape. I am physically and mentally ill from the lifestyle I've been living. I'm a first generation college graduate. So I didn't even have a map for the trail. I'm trying to get to the top. I didn't know how to get to the top of the trail. And then when you get up there, you're like, this view sucks. It's like, it reminded me of a hike that I did once in Arizona. It was at Picacho Peak. It wasn't the main hike. It was the other hike. And it went all the way up to the top. And then all it was the interstate. You're looking at the interstate. It wasn't a great view at all. That's kind of what my experience with higher education reminded me of. I also saw, like, a lot of your guests might talk about the rat race, I guess is the term, the rat race in professionalism. Where a lot of my colleagues, they want to cash in. They want the golden handcuffs of a superintendency. And I'm at that point in my life, I want to cash out. Get me out of this profession and get me back to something that's more simplistic.
When you were originally going to school for superintendency, what was your driving force? What was it that you were hoping to accomplish by being a superintendent?
Well, here's the thing. I didn't want to be a superintendent. So there's a severe mismatch between my personality and my goals and the program. And I'm not knocking the program. It's a great program if you want to be a superintendent. I think there's some nuance to this story of mine because I think a lot of my colleagues got exactly what they wanted out of the program. I applied for the program because I wanted to be the first in my family to get a doctorate, first and foremost. And then the program was called K-12 educational leadership, with a little asterisk at the bottom saying that you could pursue the superintendency if you wanted to. But upon entry, within the first few classes, I'm realizing that this is a pipeline for superintendents, which I never really wanted to be. Educational leadership doesn't have to lead just to the superintendency. You could be a CEO of a nonprofit. You could be a charter school CEO. You could work. You could create a private organization for test prep. There's different, you know, this is a huge field that was narrowed, and maybe I should have done my research more, but I never wanted to be a superintendent. So I'm seeing people who wanted to be, and it just wasn't something that spoke to me or I was interested in.
But you're still doing some of this leadership work. So how do you do that? How do you be a digital nomad? And how do you do it reputably, mm-hmm. where people aren't looking at you like, is this dude messaging me from an RV? Are we zooming from his RV? That kind of thing. How do you do that in a way where it still comes off as professional? How do you find Wi-Fi, you know, when you're roaming around in an RV? The real little things that we maybe take for granted, mm-hmm. if we're living in a house or going to a job that has all sorts of the perks, right? So how do you take care of all that?
Yeah, well, first of all, you know, in terms of Wi-Fi, we have a MiFi through AT&T that we use. So basically wherever we get cell service, this is a whole culture. So there's so many different options. You could get satellite internet, you could use a hotspot from your phone, you could use MiFi like we do, which means we're limited to places where there's cell service. So my fiance, she has more conference calls than I do. Her remote work is slightly different than mine. It's not as asynchronous as mine. It's really tied to conference calls. So we have to do our research and find state parks or campgrounds or RV parks where there is service. Sometimes, to be quite honest, we're driving to we have to stop at a Starbucks or a McDonald's or something to use their Wi-Fi and have their service for conferences. The other thing that's interesting is you could use the sewage and shower in your RV. We're choosing not to. So we use a lot of campgrounds where we're actually using the showers and services there at the campgrounds, and also using our Planet Fitness Black Card to take showers as well. So I think there's a lot of research that goes into that I guess my skills from 4 degrees help me to complete that research and look at my trajectory and where we're going and how we're going to get Wi-Fi. But you were saying about keeping it professional. Were you alluding to the predatory nature of a lot of services that are on social media?
I'm wondering if you're doing Zoom, and I don't know how much you're doing Zoom. It sounds like your fiance is doing more Zoom, and it's business up top, party down below, where you're in shorts, but you're in the suit, that sort of thing. So I'm wondering how much of that do you see? Is there a stigma that goes with your reputation as being a digital nomad, or does that not even play a factor in the work that you're doing or that your fiance is doing?
Again, I think the pandemic nudged us in this direction where more and more people had to work remotely. And then all of a sudden, all of these professional standards that we used to have we're starting to chip away at them. And I think, millennials and Gen Z have been chipping away at these standards for quite a while. I use one shirt. I don't even have it on today because I decided not to wear a professional shirt, but I have one professional shirt that I wear to every conference call. So it's kind of ridiculous. My colleagues have to catch on to it. I don't think they care. I think people are starting to not care about that because what is the meaning in that? I wore a suit for 3+ years every day as a dean of students. I didn't really get any meaning out of that. Why do we focus on that as a status symbol instead of functionality of wardrobe? And the cool thing about the remote world is they're mostly like my personality. A lot of these people don't want the 9-to-5. They went to remote work to get away from that crap. So yeah, they're business up front, like you said, nothing down below. But it's I think that's the directions it's going. And I think that's why a lot of people are enjoying remote work over let's get in a suit and tie every day and let's clock in these specific times. It's chipping away, and the pandemic's helped us move beyond that. I think that's the silver lining, right? A lot of people, for good reason, want to see the bad in this. And I think there's a lot of deficit mindset that's attached to the pandemic for obvious reasons. It's a traumatic experience for some people, but I'm looking for the silver lining. Like my father, who's a baby boomer, my father works remotely twice a week now, working for the state. He's never had that opportunity before. So during the pandemic, I'm sitting next to him. We're all in the same house. My father, my fiance and I are all working together through different generations working digitally. To me, that's exciting because it's chipping away at the old and chipping away at those old bureaucratic systems.
It kind of goes along with your philosophy about the house, though. So you spend, you buy a house and you spend all this time taking care of it. You get a job and now you're spending an extra hour out of your day getting ready for that job. It just piles more unnecessary stuff on sometimes.
If not more, if not more. I mean, you're going to dry cleaning. You have to I always wore my shoes, wore those dress shoes out so quickly. And so I'm spending money on stupid things like dry cleaning and wardrobe. And it's just so much time, eats away so much of your time.
As a boomer, how does your dad like working part-time remotely?
So at first, my dad was like, I really miss being social. at work. So he was remote full time for part of the pandemic. And then when he had to go back to work, he hates the commute now. He commutes from Pottsville, Pennsylvania to Harrisburg. Sometimes in winter weather, it's over an hour each way. And all of a sudden, now he's starting to see my perspective and my fiance's perspective on why remote work could be good, because you get more time with your family. We get more time to spend with each other. So at first he was like, I miss the social aspect. I miss my colleagues at work. And I think he struggles with change a little more than I do. But now he's like, I wish I could work remotely every damn day. And he's like, if I could push this all the way to retirement, I'm going to do it. He's hoping that he could, he's retiring in the next few years. He's hoping that he could do more remote work more days a week because he likes it so much.
You know, that socialization aspect is crucial, right? Here's the thing that I've been thinking about lately, I think this is pretty common. When you leave a job, you might not stay in contact with your former colleagues. And you have your work friends, and then you have your real friends. I mean, being honest with you, I had people who I was friends with that I was friendly with at school, but there were really maybe only four or five people out of that group that I was friends with outside of school. And so I wonder if, and I don't know the answer to this, but the pandemic taking you away from the ability to socialize about what though? About work. You're socializing about work, right? So why not take the opportunity to socialize with more friends and do things like that and do these virtual happy hours with friends, maybe not with colleagues, because then you just are back at talking about work, 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 that sort of thing. So I don't know. I've thought about that recently. I saw something. We had Dr. Dawn Graham on earlier in season three, and I saw her post something the other day about, don't feel bad if you're old work colleagues, the people that you thought were your work friends, aren't contacting you anymore. They moved on. You should too. And so that's kind of been running through my head a little bit here as I'm now entering my, 6 months out of 6 months of this leave, that sort of thing. So not staying in too much contact with my old colleagues, but trying to reconnect or make new connections. Really, that's kind of what I've been doing, is making new connections. I mean, you're a new connection that I've had, and the podcast has given me an opportunity to make new connections. And those new connections have opened up new experiences. They've opened up new relationships. And I don't know, I'm not stuck in the mire with my old colleagues. And listen, that's not a slam on my old colleagues. They're really great people. It's just, I think you're right that this pandemic, the silver lining in the pandemic, as awful as it has been, is that it has provided some people the opportunity to develop a new awareness of what meaning they want to get out of this one and only life that we have.
Yeah, one of the things that I keep reflecting on and writing about is this idea of work-life balance, which is, it's constantly fed to us, right? There's articles written about it. You go to trainings at work to discuss work-life balance. And why? Why does there have to be balance? The word itself seems like a contradiction to me. Like, why can't we just have life? Why do we have to, why do our relationships have to be bound, like you said, to work? Why can't we have stronger, deeper relationships outside of work? And why is work consuming the majority of our days in a digital era? I can't understand that. And I think you hit the nail on the head. Like, these are the pandemic has given us opportunity for new relationships and deeper. Like, I got to see my family for months during quarantine and during the height of the pandemic. And I didn't get to do that. I wasn't at home in Pennsylvania for that extended period of time before this. And to me, those relationships matters because those are the people that I really care about. And it's not that I'm an anti-social person, but I prefer deeper, more meaningful relationships.
You're looking for quality over quantity.
Quality over quantity. And sometimes in the work culture, it's like you're having work happy hours that are not necessarily mandatory, but they're mandatory. So you're kind of coerced into these superficial, artificial relationships instead of finding deeper friendships and meaning and connecting with people outside of the stress of work.
Well, I think too, the misperception around work-life balance is that if you're looking at work life as a pie, are you saying that 50% of the pie is work and the other 50% is every other aspect of life? Let's just take a look at the pie as life, and work is a slice of it. But if it's half of the pie, oh my goodness, like that means you got to jam pack every other aspect of life into that other side of the pie.
That's an unfulfilling pie.
Yeah,
it's a terrible pie.
Yeah,
it's a terrible pie. I think my last pie.
And I don't even like pie. So so now that we're all hungry and we need a snack, let's take a quick break. And then when we come back, we're going to continue talking to Dr. David DeMarcus about this pursuit for higher consciousness. Thank you for listening to The Mindful Midlife Crisis.
Thanks for listening to The Mindful Midlife Crisis. We will do our best to put out new content every Wednesday to help get you over the midweek hump. If you'd like to contact us, or if you have suggestions about what you'd like us to discuss, feel free to email us at mindfulmidlifecrisis@gmail.com or follow us on Instagram at mindful_midlife_crisis. Check out the show notes for links to the articles and resources we reference throughout the show. Oh, and don't forget to show yourself some love every now and then too. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back to the Mindful Midlife Crisis. We are here with Dr. David DeMarcus. We're talking about the pursuit for higher consciousness. Dr. DeMarcus is a digital nomad, and we've really enjoyed talking to you about your exploits here as a digital nomad and trying to make the most out of this god-awful pandemic that just doesn't want to go away. And the pandemic has had its way with a lot of people's plans, to say the least. My plans have changed significantly now because of the pandemic, and I'll talk about that next week. But your graduation from your doctoral program, this thing that you put a lot of time and definitely a lot of money into in order to earn this higher education degree, the ceremony behind that was thwarted due to the pandemic. So can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, it was. Yeah. Imagine being a first generation college student working your whole life, you know, and I got two masters on the way to the doctorate because I thought that like I had to go through a lot just to get to this doctorate. And the pandemic hits, you know, I defend my dissertation in February. And then our graduation set for May. So I defend right before the pandemic starts. And then the pandemic hits. And then a lot of these universities are caught with their pants. They don't know what to do. This is unprecedented. How do we celebrate these students? And Baylor, with all due respect, their plan was basically they put our names up on a scoreboard and it silently scrolled through our names. So basically, no, you know, you're not only missing the live cheers and the celebration, but basically it's your name silenced, the next person's name, and that's how I graduated.
No pomp and circumstance on repeat.
Say, that kind of falls short of the spectacle I think you deserve when you put all that work in.
Yeah, I mean, It was perfect, though, because it's a symbol of how anticlimactic the whole experience was for me. It was just, you know what? That's exactly what it was supposed to be. And now I'm moving on to something with more meaning and more happiness in life.
So doctoral programs are not cheap, and traveling isn't cheap either. But it sounds like the latter has been more fulfilling for you. So how do you look back on your doctoral program experience? Was that necessary for you to go through for you to pursue this higher consciousness?
And also, would you personally recommend people get a doctorate or just travel?
Oh, wow. So there's some, I think there's some nuance here, because if you look back, again, I keep going back to them, first generation college student from a small town in Pennsylvania. So I'm the first in my family to do this. With a small town comes a small mindset sometimes. So travel and college weren't separated at first. I escaped by going to college. And then I liked it so much that I wanted to see what another city was like. So why not get my master's in Milwaukee and move there? So it was a means to travel at first. And there's this huge, huge amount of growth within the first 2 degrees. Amazing professors. I'm thrust into privilege for the first time. I come from a lower income community. And that was good. That allowed, the books allowed me to explore when I didn't have the means to explore. And I think college also provides a very comfortable bubble for you to experiment. And I'm a late bloomer, obviously, I think, and to think and to mull things over before impulsively falling it is whatever you want to follow. So there's an incubation period that happens the first 2 degrees, but I think I plateaued at that third degree and I never quite recovered. You know how you're working out, and if you do the same routine over and over, you might not get growth. You have to shake it up and disrupt your body a little bit, and you have to try a new routine. Let's try yoga instead of just weightlifting, or let's incorporate running or biking for cardio. So I think I had gotten everything I needed to get out of school. I understood school. It's a system, right? It's a compliance-based system. I understood how to get through school. So I needed to shake things up a bit. And then travel has become, my self-directed, self-funded travel has become a way for me to explore, among other things, to explore outside of the ivory tower, I guess, outside of these walls, and to pursue knowledge from a different pattern or a different workout for pursuing knowledge. Would I recommend people go the path I went? No. It was the path that I thought I had to go at that time. I don't regret it, but it was also a burden that I was happy to release off my shoulders. And pursue. I'm also very thrifty. You said about cost. I'm thrifty. I got 4 degrees probably for the price of 2. I had a lot of scholarships. I had a lot of financial aid. And then travel, right? Travel is what you make of. Everyone thinks you just travel. You know, you could do the vagabond lifestyle. You don't have to spend a lot of money to hop in a car, split gas with your friends, and ride across the country, which is things I've done time and time again.
Well, and you have this note here that you think that people attach a deficit mindset to student debt. And I think this hits home for me just because my nieces and nephew are all in school right now and they're accumulating debt. And I worry about that and how they're going to dig themselves out of that. I was just having this conversation with my niece the other day, and you put a note in here that you think that too often people come out of college with this deficit mindset, saying, you know, I'm never going to conquer that. I'm drowning in debt. I'm in a hole I can't dig myself out of. And the same goes for travel. I can't afford that. I wish I could go to here, but I'll never get to there because I can't afford it. And you put in here that you're convinced that despite your disenchantment, you came out of college better than before. and you're not worried about conquering debt. So talk about that, because that kind of blows my mind a little bit. That's counterintuitive than to what I maybe would have think your message is.
Yeah, and I'm a man of contradictions, if you haven't noticed already. So I'll contradict myself from one sentence to the other. But the thing is, I have no problem investing in knowledge, right? I have no regrets pursuing higher education and dismantling generations of work, right? Because college did help me build this mindset that I have right now. The liberal arts did help me build these ideas that I'm championing right now. So, but I do think that people are afraid to invest in that, but at the same time, they'll buy, like I said, they'll buy the most ridiculous crap on a daily basis. Like, how much do you spend in a bar tab every weekend? I mean, think of in your 20s. How much did you
spend? When I was in my 20s, I ran the numbers one time, and I think it came to about $15,000 from the age of 23 to 30. Because I think I calculated it was $400 a month times 12 times 7. So it was a lot. To which I don't remember much in my 20s. I remember, and I'll tell you what, I didn't have a lot of experiences that were outside of the red carpet in St. Cloud or the bars in Rochester that I went to when I lived down there. And I think a big piece of that goes back to what we always talk about, your network equals your net worth. And listen, I love the friends that were in my life at that time, but there's that old saying too, that you are the average of all your friends put together. And that's who I was at that time. I like to go out and have a drink. I wasn't investing in my maturity. I wasn't investing in my social emotional growth. And I'm playing catch up at this point. When you're having anxiety attacks and struggling with suicidal ideation in your mid-30s, what is your behavior in your 20s? Maybe something that contributed to that? For me, I think yes, completely. And it's what's funny is, coming out of this trip that I was in Oregon, spent a lot of time alone, which means I spent a lot of time with my thoughts, which is not always a good thing. So when I woke up today, I was in a funk and I had to journal. I had to get it out. There were things that were on my mind. And so I got it out. Mm-hmm. And after probably about an hour, I felt a little better, but it's lingering here today. It's kind of like getting over a sickness, right? So it's lingering a little bit.
Well, part of the, I didn't talk about sobriety. Sobriety has been a whole part of this pursuit of higher consciousness for me. I'm sober for 17 months coming up.
Good for you.
Thank you. Yeah. And it's weird, but, you know, and it's not for everyone. I'm not being puritanical. I know it's right for me because I started drinking at 14. You know, when you start drinking at 14, like you said, your emotional growth over time, you're drinking from 14 really hard. You know, really hard for me until 24, and then still drinking a little after. But I mean, binge drinking for 14 to 24. My emotional growth is done. I'm playing catch up too, man. All of my growth from adolescence to adulthood surrounded alcohol. You know, one of the most revolutionary things I did during this whole journey is I chose sobriety, because that was the one thing I never did throughout my life. And I regret how much money I spent on alcohol. So it's weird that this is coming up with a conversation for education, but I think we pay for things like that. We pay for consumerism. We'll pay 500 plus thousands of dollars for a mortgage. But, you know, why should I feel sorry for investing in my education when there's also things like that we're spending our money on? So I think this is going back to that conversation with education. But yeah, sobriety, man, I mean, I'm a huge proponent of it. It doesn't work for everyone, but it's worked wonders for me that I'm able to think consciously for the first, because I was unconscious like you during my 20s, especially.
And I think that relates back to what Aaron Boyke talked about and what Greg Scheinman talked about. Even coaches need coaches, and we can benefit from investing in working with a coach. And I am on the precipice of working with a coach right now, whether it's a life coach or whether it's a personal trainer, because I'm in a funk right now. I think the thing that's stopping me is I'm not working. So I'm living off of my savings, and it's been ingrained in me to be frugal and to be responsible with my money. But how many times did I go out to eat when I was in Portland, right? And I had access to a kitchen at the Airbnb that I was at in Portland. So I could have eaten smarter. I didn't have to have a drink when I was down in Portland, those sort of things. And they add up. So I think you make a good point. And I think this is another thing too, that I hope our listeners understand, that Brian and I have talked about, we're not perfect living, breathing examples of what everybody should do. We're working through this as much as anybody else is. And I think that I need to sit down and take a look at, what is it that I'm spending my money on that could be better invested in myself? Because there's a difference. You can spend and you can invest. And
yes,
yeah,
definitely.
I think I need to take an inventory on that. And David, you and I talked about this, about like starting a group. And we talked about this when I talked to Dr. Yolanda and Tiffany Bird. Can you imagine the four of us get together and form this group where we're helping people live their best lives? Whew, I think we could just crush it.
Yeah. Oh, I think it's a great idea. I think it's necessary. Like I said, one of the reasons it's really hard for me to tell my story right now is I'm in the middle of this. One, I'm a divergent thinker, so I'm going to be over the place a little bit, all over the place. But the other thing is, I'm in the midst of this, and people like me could really, and I'm about to come out of it, I think, but there's people like me that are at the beginning of this that could really benefit from some sort of cohort and coaching, even if it's emotional support, design thinking cohort, or, you know, vision boarding. Like, there's just conversations about how the hell do we navigate this thing that we're never taught to navigate. You know, we're taught how to get through school, but we're never taught how to pursue meaning. I don't think traditional education always focuses on how to pursue meaning.
No,
it's
definitely
how to pursue.
Not.
You're right. It's how to pursue professionalism or finances. And the other thing I want to say is, I think it's awesome that you're thinking about looking at your finances. I've done I'm really pretty radical with this right now. I haven't gotten a haircut in 3 years. You know, I used to spend like $60 or more to get a fade all the time with my haircut. And my hair grows fast, so I'm paying like $60 every, you know, 2 weeks just on a haircut. It sounds so tiny, but that extra money that I get from that, I get to invest that into travel or opportunities where I get to learn experientially. And then I've also placed a ban on purchases for clothes. So I'm in a 3-year ban right now currently on purchasing clothes. So I just wear workout gear. I have like 5 outfits. I'm not changing. I don't need professional outfits. And that's also saving money, because think about how much money you save on new wardrobes over time. But yes, I think that's worth considering. And also, I love the idea of bringing group together.
Well, and Greg Scheinman introduced me to Brian Gallagher. You can follow him at Simple Man Guide. And he's coaching people to do just what you're pursuing to do. And that's actually who I'm looking to work with. And he said that he would join us on the show here at some point. So when we get going with season 5, I'm almost certain we'll be able to have Brian on there. I think he's going to be a fascinating person to talk to. Awesome. As well. Sometimes I feel like people think the only way to experience higher consciousness is through travel. So that then gets in the way of their ability to simply listen to what the universe is trying to share with them. So through your experiences, through your research, how have others beside yourself pursued this idea of higher consciousness?
Yeah, I mean, if you're limiting it just to travel, I think it's a great disservice to this pursuit of higher consciousness, because I think there's also other routes. Like if you, first of all, is there one route to higher consciousness? Do we know? Like, this is, am I ever going to actually achieve it? Or is it just something that you pursue for the rest of life? I'm willing to bet it's more of a pursuit than this.
It's a practice, yeah.
Transcendence or this, yeah, a practice that I'm completely comfortable with, you know, knowing that it's a goal I may never reach. It's a goal that I pursue through practice, but it's not a reward maybe at the end of the road. I've been listening to a lot of audiobooks lately. I think people find higher consciousness through flow. I think athletes, a lot of the time it's underestimated, athletes in an athletic flow that allows you to be really in tune with the moment, but also feel like you're transcending the moment. Like, have you guys watched Free Solo?
Yes. And I was white knuckled the entire time, the last 20 minutes, even though I know the guy survives, I'm white knuckled the entire time because it's so terrifying to watch.
Yeah. I think a lot of people can find the pursuit of higher consciousness to like meditation or maybe religious practice. But I look at something like that idea of free souling, and I'm looking at reading about other people who are alpinists who are pursuing these amazing athletic feats that allow them to be completely in the now, but also transcend the normal circumstances of society. So I wonder, I'm the type of person that needs to do something physically to actually meditate instead of being still. And it's not for everyone, but I think it's worth considering that some people can pursue higher consciousness through, you know, even on the road, as I'm driving, I'm meditating, I'm thinking on the road. And I'm being consciously aware of inputs and outputs. What's going into my body? I talked about sobriety, but also, am I feeding into the news cycle? Am I feeding into toxic stuff on social media? Or am I in books, listening to audiobooks, listening to music? You know, those inputs are just as important as food. And then outputs is I'm trying to limit my own toxicity, because social media can be really toxic. So I want my outputs not to seem toxic to some other people. I think solitude is something that's a recurring theme of other people's pursuits for higher consciousness. You think about old priests and ascetics or Buddhist monks sometimes pursue solitude. I find that solitude in a different way. I find it on the trails. I think there's a lot of people who also love hiking or love the outdoors because that solitude allows them the space for thought that they're not always allowed in other contexts. And yeah, those are essentially some of the things I've been thinking about as I'm reading and as I'm trying to figure out what this means. I'm not really a spiritual person in a traditional sense. So I get that metaphysical feelings or sensations in other ways, such as hiking, road trips, travel.
So where does the pursuit for higher consciousness take you next?
Ooh, okay. Yeah. So I am traveling. I'm going abroad for the next few months. So I'll be in the Dominican and Costa Rica. What I would really like to do is continue my routine. I'm in a pretty good routine right now in terms of, you know, I'm reading at a faster pace than I ever read during my time in a doctorate. I'm working out consistently. I'm eating healthy. I'm taking time to meditate on the trails and to think. And I'm writing a lot and I'm creating a lot. Creativity is an important part of this process, I think, with social media. So I would like to continue this track. And then I think, like, like I said, it's a pursuit. So I don't know exactly where it's going to go from there, but I know that those are the core values and routines that I'm going to keep.
How much does environment play a role in all of that? Because is there a specific reason you chose the Dominican Republic and Costa Rica, or is it because they're warm? And because we talked about that, you like being a snowbird. So how is the environment conducive to your pursuit?
Yeah. So I've realized through this process that a lot of, you know, I get seasonally depressed. I need sunshine. So I lived in Vermont and Milwaukee, and I grew up in Pennsylvania. A lot of the winters were brutal in those years. And I realized that, hey, I have a choice. Part of being conscious is I have conscious choices that I get to make, and I could eliminate winter by going to places like the Dominican Republic and being able to be in sunshine and 80-degree weather in the middle of January or February. And that, to me, is important. Because it helps you, for me specifically, I wasn't a skier or a snowboarder, so I'm not as physically active in the winter. So I like sunshine because it pushes me out to kayak or to go biking or just to go outside running or to just stay fit. How do you guys feel? Like, is it you're both from Minnesota?
Yes.
Like, have you experienced different, like, personal vibrations during the winter where you're lower, or is
most
it
definitely
your thing where
seasonal what do they call that, seasonal mood disorder or something,
seasonal affect disorder. It's sad. The letters are SAD, sad, because you are really fucking sad. It's winter in Minnesota. And a credit to so many Minnesotans out there who are tough out there, who are braving it out there. It's just not for me, man. It's just not for me. And
gets
tougher
every year too.
Yeah. And that's kind of why I asked, how is environment conducive to your pursuit for higher consciousness? Because I've talked about it before. Portugal felt like home for me. I've never felt so at ease. I've never felt so at home. And even actually staying at my sister's, as rainy as it's been here, this structure here that I am in, it feels very homey. I feel very content here. And I know that she doesn't want me to feel too at home because she wants me to leave at some point. But it does feel like home here, and I feel very at ease here, but there is also a longing to go back to Portugal, and it would be great to go to other places, but right now I just have this calling to go to Portugal, and that's where I guess I see myself, and I feel like there's something about the energy of your environment that allows you to be more in tune with yourself and with your, like you said, your vibrations, that sort of thing. And again, chalk that up to things you never would have heard me say 2 or 3 years ago.
Oh yeah. Yeah. I don't think I would hear, like, some of the stuff I'm spewing here, I would never ever say years ago. You know, I was the type of guy that was like, what are these influencers doing always ranting on social media? Why are they so happy? Why do they look so freaking happy? I'm not happy. And I had to, you know, I had to call myself out on my own BS. Is like, you're not happy, dude, because you don't want to be happy. You don't want to make the conscious choices that influencer or whoever made to be happy. And I think environment's huge. I eliminate winter. It's been great. It's been great for my mental health. You know, I think if you're feeling Portugal, if that's the vibration that you're feeling right now, man, I encourage you to go and see what that means. Maybe you need to live in Portugal. Like, maybe that's where your future is. I mean, you could do this podcast while you're still there, right?
We've done
it before.
If this
podcast is, you could do that. You could carry your work with you. So do that if that's what's making you feel good.
And I think it's important just to recognize that we're not saying you need to become a snowbird. We're saying it's important for you to recognize the things that you need to eliminate in order to feel the vibrations in order to feel in tune, in order to discover that level of higher consciousness. And,
you know, as I'm posting on social media, as I'm speaking here, I don't want people to follow the same path as me. That's not my goal. My goal is not to be a snake oil salesman on social media that says, follow me. You know, that sounds pretty cult-like. And I think that people, yeah, like you're saying, I think people need to make this conscious choice of what it is they want in life, how they want to customize their own life, and how they could find their own pursuit of higher consciousness or happiness. So it's not follow me, I know the path. It's follow your gut, follow your heart, follow your trajectory onto the next steps in life.
Well, if you want to follow Dr. David on social media, you can certainly do that. Go to Instagram, look up Feral_visions. Dr. David, we wish you the best on your pursuit for higher consciousness, man. I'm excited to continue to follow along and learn and connect with you and pursue my own level of higher consciousness.
Thank you for having me on this podcast. It's my first public appearance since I left public education. And I was really nervous, obviously, but really my cup is full coming out of this, and I hope other people's cup are as full as mine is right now.
Well, we're honored that we were your first public appearance.
Yeah, thank you.
Welcome back to society, my friend.
Yeah, man, it's been, I've been out.
So with that, for Dr. David, for Brian, I'm Billy. Thank you for listening to The Mindful Midlife Crisis. May you feel happy, healthy, and loved. Take care, friends. Thank you for taking the time to listen to the Mindful Midlife Crisis podcast. We hope you enjoyed this week's episode. If this episode resonates with you, please share it with your family and friends. We will do our best to put out new content every Wednesday to get you over the midweek hump. If you want episodes to be downloaded automatically to your phone each week, all you need to do is hit the check mark, subscribe, like, or follow button, depending on what podcast format you're using. While you're at it, feel free to leave our show a quick 5-star review with a few kind words so more people like you can easily find our show. If you're really enjoying the show and you want to help us out, feel free to make a donation to www.buymeacoffee.com/MMC podcast. That's www.buymeacoffee.com/MMC podcast. You can also access the link in our show notes. We use the money from these donations to pay whatever expenses we incur from producing the show. But ultimately, we record this show for you. So if you keep listening, we'll keep recording and releasing new episodes each week regardless. If you'd like to contact us, or if you have suggestions about what you'd like us to discuss on future episodes, feel free to email us at mindfulmidlifecrisis@gmail.com or follow us on Instagram at mindful_midlife_crisis. Be sure to check out the show notes for links to the articles and resources we reference throughout the show. Thanks again for listening. May you feel happy, healthy, and loved.